For the brother that we all, that a lot of us knew for a long time, Brother Namir, who died of cancer, and he was suffering for a whole year. He's the nephew of Dr. Rashid Haki. And a lot of those people who have been here in this community for a long time, they know him. He passed away yesterday and was put to rest today. So inshallah, we ask you all to recite a Surah Fatiha for him and all the marhumin, inshallah. حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين أما بعد فقد قال الله الحكيم في كتابه المتين بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولقد كان لكم في رسول الله أسوة حسنة صلوات على محمد
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
again the I give congratulations to all of you and all the believers, and especially the Imam of our time, for the birth of the beloved of Allah, Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Everyone wants to love Allah, but Allah loves Muhammad.
This is
something that we want to know. Right? Everyone wants to love Allah, but Allah loves Muhammad. So if you want Allah to love us, we just need to know we should love the one that Allah loves. And hence, we are the lovers of Muhammad. Right? We are those people who are in love with Muhammad. May Allah bless him and give his salutations on him. And also on his grandson, through whom we know of the Prophet, the Imam of our time that we are now. On the same day, as you have heard, his birthday also falls, which is Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, alayhi salatu wassalam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Obviously, the life of the Prophet is something that we have been discussing since last year. And we are going to continue the discussion, inshallah, from today this year. And what better occasion is there than the birth of the Prophet to begin the discussion this year of his life and his seerat, his example that Allah had set for us and has said, وَلَقَدْ كَانَ لَكُمْ فِي رَسُولِ اللَّهِ أُسْوَةٌ حَسَنًا, that in the Messenger of Allah is the best example for you. Right? In every facet of life, how to live our lives, how to wake up, how to sleep, how to pray, everything we look at in life, we see the example for that is the Prophet, the Messenger. And hence, we are discussing about his life. And until now, last year, we had spent the time in learning about the ancestors of the Prophet. We went through his childhood, his conception, his birth, his childhood, and his young age, his trade, his business, his wife, his marriage, until we came to this point where now the declaration of prophethood is going to be made. We reach this stage now that the Prophet is going to declare himself as the Prophet, and that time now you see is approaching. And I'll explain some of the things, and I'm just going to describe today the situation at the time of his declaration, of him declaring what was the situation then. Because in order to understand the effects of his message and the reaction of the people to his message and to what he wanted them to do, we need to understand the background and the environment in which this declaration was made, in which this announcement was made. And hence, when we learn that, then we will know what was the announcement and what effect it had in that environment that they were living in. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
The environment at the time of the Arabs, that place which was known as Hijaz, it was a people who were cut off from the rest of the world. Meaning that this was a population of people, and Allah had wisely chosen this place for Ibrahim to go and establish Ismail there. It was chosen because this was a place which was geographically isolated from the rest of the world. If you look at it, there are mountains on both sides. Mountains on this side, mountains on that side. And hence, these were the this place, if population grows here, it will be geographically also cut off from the rest of the world, rest of the place. And because it is geographically cut off from the rest of the place, it is called Hijaz. Hijaz means to be cut off. Right? It means to be cut off, to be isolated. Right? That's what it means. And hence, this was, and being in that situation of isolation, you see certain ideologies had developed amongst the people who lived there. One of the things that happens when you're isolated from the rest of the world, or you're cut off from the rest of the world, and you are, you know, like for example, on your own, and you grow on your own, one of the effects that happens is that to you, the whole world is you and no one but you. I didn't say that, but I was alluding to that so that you know what I'm talking about. One of the psychology of being cut off from the world is that now everything is just about you. No one else matters. Everyone else is nothing. If they live or die, it doesn't matter to you as long as you are alive and you are well. This is the reason why you see that to the Arabs who lived in that area, to them, no one outside of the outside of that region was important. Meaning their life had no value, their property obviously had no value. Right? You can do anything you want with them because to them, those people did not count. That's why you see even in language, the Arabic language, they were so proud of their language that everyone else they used to call Ajam. Meaning Ajam means someone who cannot speak. Right? Someone who cannot speak. Someone who is mute. Who is not able to express himself. And hence, you see that the people were such that to them everyone else was mute. Everyone else was deaf. They didn't have the right to exist. This is the reason, one of the reasons why that age was called the days of Jahiliyyah. Ignorance. And the ignorance that they had was the fact that to them, they were the only ones who counted and others did not count. And this also, you see, when that happens, you see even within themselves, they had that psychology and that ideology. You look at this. Each tribe, if you did not belong to a tribe, then your life was not worth anything. Meaning, if you belong to a tribe, then you have a life, then you have, for example, friends, then you have protection. If you don't belong to a tribe, then it's as if you're nothing. Each tribe only cares for itself. And that's the reason, for example, a lot of times to them, if some other tribe member used to be killed, you see that? This tribe would be like, okay, so what? Well, he's dead. He's another, you know, so he's not from our tribe. To them, if you're not from our tribe, then, you know, who cares if you die? You know, it's not important. Understand this. This was the psychology because of which they were called the days of Jahiliyyah. This is psychology by which they were called the days of Jahiliyyah. Right? And those were the days of Jahiliyyah. We are living in the new Jahiliyyah.
Yeah, that's correct.
Right? The same Jahiliyyah that was there, but, you know, the same psychology, the same ideology, but you see, it was the same days of Jahiliyyah. So that on one side, they were ignorant. Right? Ignorant. And in the other side, not only were they ignorant, but they were arrogant also. You see, when you are ignorant, it's one thing. But on the other hand, they were arrogant. Their pride and their arrogance was such that to them, they will not let anything happen that will put them down in front of others. They would do whatever it takes to maintain their pride and their arrogance. This was the situation of those people then. If you look at it, you'll see. The whole practice of burying daughters was because of this. The reason that the Arabs used to bury their daughters is not because they didn't like girls, or they didn't want to have girls. The reason they used to bury them is because of the fact that when this girl grows up, she's going to get married. When she gets married, obviously in those days and even now in the Muslim world, in Muslim environments, marriages is a union of two families. You know, when she gets married, then you have a son-in-law. Now, what used to happen, what does happen is that the son-in-law, if he, you know, he can dishonor you by harming your daughter or doing something to your daughter. And because of this, their respect and their position would fall down. And they did not want to be looked down by their son-in-law, who is a stranger for them. They did not want to be put down before the in-laws. And so in order to protect themselves from facing that situation where their respect and honor is at stake, they made the practice of killing the daughters before they grow up. It was a practice that was done so that they can protect their honor and pride. That they would kill their daughters instead of letting them grow and face the situation where they will be looked down by their in-laws. You see, this was the practice. And this was a practice that when you see there, it was out of the pride that they had. The arrogance that they had. There was one person became Muslim and he went to the Prophet, right, and said that, you know, I want to clear something. I want to clear something up. Ya Rasulullah. What is it? He says, I have something to confess, and I want to clear it from my mind. It's been bothering me. He said, what happened? He says, in the days of Jahiliyyah, I had 6 daughters, and I buried all of them.
Oh, Allah.
I buried all of them. And I had some sons also, but I had six daughters. I buried all of them. And to me, you know, that was just a practice. You know, if you had a daughter, you just bury it. You know, you don't even ask questions. That's it.
Wow.
My wife was pregnant. Right? My wife was pregnant. And I had to go on a trip, a journey. My wife was pregnant and I had to go on a journey. When I went on the journey, I told my wife that, listen, right? If it's a boy, give me the good news. If it's a girl, you know what to do. Right? Right? If it's a girl, don't even inform me. Don't even bother telling me. Right? Just go ahead and bury it. Right? I don't need anyone to know. When I come back, I'll understand. Right? I'll understand. But if it's a boy, of course, you know, I'll get the good news. So when I came back, you know, there was no baby in the house. And right? It's over. It's finished. You know? And I went on living. He went on living. After a while, I noticed that, you know, after some years, I noticed that my wife used to go to the neighbors and play with the children there. More than usual. Frequently. And I asked her, you know, what is it with you? You know, your husband's in the house and you're going to your neighbor's house. I mean, you know, is everything all right? Isn't that? And, you know, she said, no, nothing, nothing. Isn't that? Until I pressured her. I pressured her and then she told me that, you know, that she had a child and it was a girl. But she did not bury her. She did not bury her. She gave it to the neighbors to raise. And then she introduced me to my daughter. Well, a young girl then, you know. Young girl, she introduced me to my daughter and said, this is your father. The girl came and hugged me, you know, and, you know, saying, you know, daddy and baba, and she hugged me. I looked at her in the eyes, and then I said, you know, and obviously by this time the prophet was crying, and the companions were saying to stop, asking him to stop, but the prophet said, no, go on, go on. He said, I looked at the eyes of my daughter, and I saw her. And then I said, let's go for a walk. I took her, holding her hand. I went outside into the desert. I made a hole in the ground. I put her in the ground. I asked her to go inside. She went inside herself. She listened to her father. She trusted me. And I saw her inside the grave. Then I started to put the sand in the grave. And it was at that time where she was calling out to me. And her hands were raised towards me and she was calling out to me and saying that, Father. And I looked at her, her eyes, the last time, and I put the dirt on her face. And that's how I buried her. And I heard that this is in my mind, it's lingering in my mind, and I just want to see that if Islam, I mean, if I accepted Islam, is all of that forgiven? My past, because Islam is that when you accept Islam, your past is forgiven. He asked the Prophet that, is my past forgiven? And the Prophet said, you know, and he was grieved, he was crying, and he said that when you accept Islam, what you have done in ignorance is forgiven. But you'll have to live with this. He says, well, if I am forgiven, then alhamdulillah, I'm happy. And he smiled and laughed and joked and walked away. But you see, this was the people that the Prophet had to give the message to. This was the ignorance that the Prophet had to raise and eradicate. This was the individuals that the Prophet had to make into human beings. Imagine, you know, what kind of people were there? On one hand, they were ignorant. On the other hand, they were arrogant. Their pride was such that if, as long as their respect and their name is safe, they're good. We don't care about others. And if keeping my name means if I have to kill my daughters, if I have to kill people for it, I will do it. You know, I will do that in order to maintain my name and my respect. This, my friends, this is the attitude now. Now, you heard about the ignorance, you heard about the arrogance. Now, above that, more than their ignorance and arrogance, these people were also religious people.
Yes. Wow. Yes.
These people were religious people. They used to devote their lives to their gods. They used to pray every night next to their beds. You know, they used to kneel down and they used to pray every night to their gods. Right? In fact, they love their guards so much that they would take their guards everywhere they go so that they can pray while they're traveling. Yeah. This was their habit. Meaning that they had stones, right? That they would put these stones, you know, like four stones they used to carry. This was their practice. They would have four stones. They would lay down three stones in a triangle and put one on top and then worship that. Everywhere they go, whenever they felt like, you know, they wanted to make a god to worship, they would make their own god. You know, it's like a Legos god, you know. Putting Lego pieces together, making a god. So, you had these Legos god that they used to worship every time. And then you imagine that this is their religiousness and ignorance. This is how religious they were. And then you imagine that, okay, they take these stones and they believe them to be God. I mean, stones, rocks, they believe them to be God. Now, what was the problem when the prophet came and said, listen, I'm not God, I'm the messenger of God. Imagine this. They would accept stones as God, but they wouldn't accept a human being as the messenger of God. They believed the stones to be God, and at the same time, they did not believe that a person can be the messenger of God. I mean, it makes no sense. Completely illogical. Why would they do that? You see, actually it's not illogical. It's very logical.
Very logical.
Very logical, my friends. Right? If you are smart like they are, they also know what they're doing. Right? You see, they worship rocks. They said that these stones are God. But they said that this person is not God. He's not the messenger of God. Understand that? Exactly. Why? Because of the fact that they knew that the rocks don't talk.
Exactly.
Rocks don't say anything. And hence, the mind of the mushrik is that worship something that doesn't talk and cannot talk back. And this mushrik, this quality of shirk existed even in Islam. Before Islam, you see mushrikeen, they rejected the one who talks as being the messenger. But they accepted a rock as a god. After Islam, the same ideology existed. When the Prophet gave two things, one that is talking and one which is silent, mushrikeen accepted the silent and they rejected the talking. You see, that same idea still existed after Islam. You see, many things existed after Islam. And I'll tell you those things. Right? What happens? So now you see this on one hand and the behind. Ignorance, arrogance, and religious. I mean, this is a dangerous combination. I was thinking about born again, but... Salawat ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
You see, now understand this, my friend, understand this, right? This is what's happening. You see, this was a situation at that, on one hand. Right? People were completely into their own world. They were arrogant about themselves and did not have any care for anyone else's life. And on the other hand, they were into their own religion and they were very much religious. So now, how do you come to these people? This is on one hand. How did the Prophet even get people to accept Islam? I mean, how did he even get people to accept Islam? Right? This is something that needs to be answered, and you also need to know this so that you understand why were there people who accepted Islam right at the outset of the message. Then you will understand this. Oh, it's more than a miracle, friend. Understand this. I'm going to tell you a story by of four friends. These four friends who had a meeting. And the meeting was at this fair, or this, you can say this annual ziyarat that the Meccans used to have. Amongst the guards of the Meccans, the most precious guard, his name was Dawama.
Obama?
Salawat ala. The most precious guard to those people was called Dawama. This guard Dawama, the reason he was special is because you could only, you know, worship him once a year. Right? Once a year. You know, he's open for ziyarat once a year. And everyone used to, even those who did not worship other guards, the other idols, they would respect this idol because he was rare to get to. He was once a year thing, and it was a big thing. And everyone used to go there. Why? Even we have like false hadith and riwayat about the Prophet. Right? That his family, they all used to go there. This hadith is there in, not in our books. Not in our books. But in Muslim books. And Sahih books. Sahih Bukhari has this. Muslim has this. That they used to go there. They used to go there for this worship. And they used to tell the Prophet, why don't you come? You're disrespecting the family because all the family used to go together all at once. It was a, you know, like a big thing. You know, like now we have a, you know, like for everyone, like without the whole family, right? It goes to see the Christmas tree, you know, once a year thing. Like everyone goes there, right, to see that. So it's like when one of you doesn't come and one of the family doesn't come, it's like, why aren't you coming? Everyone's like, you know, everyone goes here, you know. It's like everyone does this. You know, how can you not do this, you know? So, at that time, you know, this is not our hadith. Again, I'm saying, this is not from our books. It is from Bukhari and Muslim and these books that are there, right? The Prophet said that, you know, no, I don't want to come. He was making excuses, and then one time he said, alright, I'll come. Right? I'll come for the worship. So he intended to go there for the worship. And then as he went there, something happened on the way, and it didn't happen. He didn't get a chance to worship. So then he came back, so, and then at the end there's a note that says, Allah saved him. But the intention was there. Right? The intention was there that he wanted to go there. But the thing is that this was such a big thing, this God, right? Obviously this history is not in our books, the Prophet never did that. To us, the Prophet does not even intend to do evil and wrong. The intention of evil cannot come in his mind. He is masoom in that way. Not just that he doesn't sin. Masoom doesn't mean that someone who doesn't sin. Masoom means someone who doesn't even intend to sin. Someone who doesn't think about sinning. That's the meaning of masoom. Like many people whose lives are led and they never sin. Right? They're not masoom. Masoom means the one who doesn't even think about sinning. It doesn't even cross his mind that he could sin. Right? It's like that. So this is different. Right? That's That's not. So all these hadiths are false, and you know they're not with us. But the issue that happened is this: when all the people, when all the Arabs were going there to this thing, there were four friends who met each other. Right? These four friends, their name was Waraqa ibn Nawfal, Uthman ibn Huwaira, Ubaidullah ibn Jahash, and Zayd ibn Amr. Four friends. And I'll introduce them to you soon. Because these four had a lot to do with the declaration of prophethood and what happened after that. They played a key role, right, in different ways. You see this. Waraqa ibn Nawfal. You know Waraqa ibn Nawfal as being the cousin of the wife of the Prophet Khadija. He was a cousin who, if you remember the time of the marriage of Khadija, when her uncle had said no to the Prophet's proposal. So it was Waraqa ibn Nawfal who got involved and arranged for the marriage. Right? So this Waraqa ibn Nawfal was there, one of them. Now, all these four friends met, right? And in that meeting they looked at their people and said, what has happened to our people? How stupid have they become that they are worshipping these idols? How stupid have they become that they are worshipping these idols? Right? They rejected the idol worship. They said, we will make an oath that we will never worship these idols. And that the religion of our people is wrong. And there must be a right religion out there somewhere. There must be the truth somewhere. We will look for the truth. They made that oath. They rejected the idols. They rejected the batil. And they now went their own separate ways from that meeting to find the truth. And all four had been led in different directions. Right? All of them made the direction. But they all agreed that they rejected the batil. They rejected idols. Now they went to find the truth. So at first was Waraqa ibn Nawfal. He went to find the truth and he found monks. He learned under them. He memorized the Old Testament and the New Testament. He memorized the Zabur. Memorized the Holy Book. And hence he had that marifat in him to recognize the Prophet also. That when he saw, when he knew that this is the Prophet, he recognized him before he was, he declared himself to be a prophet. That was Waraqa ibn Nawfal. It was there. The other person, Uthman ibn Huwaira, was also the cousin of Khadija. Her father's name was Khufayl. And he had two brothers, Huwaira and Nufayl. And both of those had the son, one of them is Waraqa ibn Nawfal, and the other one is Uthman ibn Huwaira. He was also there. And he also went out to search for the truth. He went to Sham, which was like the center of religion at that time, where, for example, Christianity was there. And he went there, became a Christian, and he died there. Right, in that. And which is, in Islam, alright. Because in Islam, before the Prophet came in, before Islam came, there were three religions that were valid. One was the religion of Musa, the other one was the religion of Isa, the third one was the religion of Ibrahim. Right, Deen Ibrahim, you can be either in his religion, you can be a Christian, or you can be a Jew. After Islam, all of them were abrogated. All of them were finished after Islam came. Now it's not valid to go to any other religion. Right? Allah Himself says that clearly in the Quran. وَمَن يَبْتَغِ غَيْرَ الْإِسْلَامَ دِينًا فَلَن يُقْبَلَ مِنْهُ. It will not be accepted from him. So now what happened is that he accepted Christianity, he died there. Now we come to the third person. And I'm mentioning these people, and then I'll explain about the last person more in detail. The third person, his name was Ubaidullah ibn Jahash. Now who is this Ubaidullah ibn Jahaz? He is from Bani Hashim. He is the cousin of the Prophet. He is the son of the paternal aunt of the Prophet by the name of Sumayya, Abu Talib's sister. Right? Her son, his name is Ubaidullah ibn Jahash. To introduce who Ubaidullah ibn Jahash is, if you ever heard the incident about Zainab bint Jahash, she was the cousin of the Prophet also, the sister of Ubaidullah. His sister was Zainab bint Jahash that the Prophet married to Zaid, his servant, right? And then it did not work out, so after the divorce, he married her himself. That was Zainab bint Jahash, who was the sister of Ubaidullah ibn Jahash. And this Ubaidullah's, this other brother, to let you all know who he is, Abdullah ibn Jahash, he was martyred in Uhud, in the Battle of Uhud, and his grave is with the grave of Hamza. They are right next to each other. Right? His grave is right next to him. This Ubaidullah ibn Jahash, he also went out to search for the truth, but he did not like Christianity. He was not convinced with Judaism or any of these religions. He went out to search the truth. He looked around to see where things are happening, and he couldn't find anything until the Prophet declared Islam, and he was one of the few first people who accepted Islam. He was one of the first people who accepted Islam. So now you see, he rejected the idols even before the Prophet came. He rejected the idols. Then he accepted the Islam when the Prophet came, and he migrated to Ethiopia with Jaafar at-Tayyar. He migrated there. He was there in Ethiopia. When he went to Ethiopia, of course, you know, you need to know the ending also. When he went to Ethiopia, it was a major place for Christianity where he met many big ulama of the Christians and this and that. And he was influenced by them and he became a Christian. So, he became a Christian and he became the first apostate of Islam. The first murtad of Islam, Ubaidullah ibn Jahash. His wife was Umme Habiba. Umme Habiba was his wife, the daughter of Abu Sufyan. No. Yeah. Understand this, my friends. Do not judge a book by its cover.
That's right.
Do not judge a book by its cover. He married Umme Habiba, the daughter of Abu Sufyan. Understand this, right? You want to know the rest of the story. Ubaidullah ibn Jahash was from Bani Hashim. Umme Habiba was from Bani Umayyah. Ubaidullah ibn Jahash was the cousin of the Prophet. Umme Habiba was the daughter of Abu Sufyan. Understand this, my friends, very clearly. Ubaidullah ibn Jahash became a murtad to such an extent that he used to ridicule the Muslims in Ethiopia. He used to make fun of them in Ethiopia. He used to say that, listen, open your eyes. I have opened my eyes. I'm not closed-minded now. You should also open your eyes. He used to make jokes about the Muslims there, and the Muslims were like looking at him, who was one of them, now became a Christian, and he's now making jokes about them. Right? And you see this Ubaidullah ibn Jahash, he died as a murtad there. And this Umme Habiba, when she saw that Ubaidullah ibn Jahash, her husband, became a murtad, she left him. She left him and said, no, I cannot leave my religion, you go ahead. She left him. When she left him, you see, right away the Prophet sent his proposal for her and asked her to become his wife. Umme Habiba, the daughter of Abu Sufyan, was the wife of the Prophet. Right? And you see how she became the wife of the Prophet because of this incident, that when her husband became an apostate and a murtad, now he took her as a wife. Right? So that she could be rewarded for that decision she made to leave her husband and not a religion. Right? This is the decision she made. It's not easy. In those days especially it wasn't easy. Right, to leave your husband and just stick to your religion, it wasn't easy, especially Islam. Islam wasn't even, you know, practiced then, you know, a minority. Understand, this was my friend, understand. So now what happened is that guy became a murtad. The same guy who accepted, who rejected the idols through his own, using his own intellect, he rejected the idols. He rejected the batil. He said this was wrong. But when it came to haq and when it came to truth, that's when you see he was not able to do that. He was not able to get there. Wow. Now the last person, Zayd ibn Amr. Zayd ibn Amr, this person, to introduce him to you, he was the first cousin of Umar ibn Khattab. He's the first cousin of Umar ibn Khattab. Umar ibn Khattab's father and his father were brothers. And Zayd ibn Amr, to introduce him to you, his son, Sayyid ibn Zayd. If you ever heard this story of Umar, when he went to assassinate the Prophet. He went to assassinate the Prophet and he met someone on the way and they said that, listen, why do you want to go and kill him? What do you want to go and kill him for? Right? Go back in your own home and see that your nephew has accepted Islam. And this nephew was Sayyid ibn Zayd. When he went back and he did see them reading the Quran, reciting the Quran, and so Umar beat them up until they bled. The wife of Sayyid said, listen, you can kill us if you want to, but we are not leaving this religion. And so what happened is that he then asked, well, you know, if this is what you believe in, now you tell me, what about this religion? So they recited some verses of Surah Taha for him. Later on, he was affected by that and became Muslim. He became Muslim then. But what happened is this. The father of Umar, Khattab, when Zayd ibn Amr wanted to find the truth, he did not like Christianity, he did not like Judaism. He heard about Deen Ibrahim, right? Religion of Ibrahim. He went out looking for it in Makkah. He asked everyone in Makkah about, do you know anything about Deen Ibrahim? Anyone who follows it. He did not get any answer. No answer came. So when he looked around there and saw that he couldn't find it, then he said to his wife that I'm leaving Makkah to go elsewhere to see if anyone else knows about Deen Ibrahim. I know that this is the right deen. This is the right religion. His wife, she told him, she went to Khattab and said that, listen, you know, your nephew is, you know, has these plans to leave Makkah to look for Deen Ibrahim. So he came and he beat him up. Right? He beat him up. He says, you know, and when he was bleeding and all that, then he said, all right, you know, is that enough of Deen Ibrahim or you want more? Right? He says, listen, I'm going to look for Deen Ibrahim. He says, listen, nephew, don't do this. Right? Don't do this. You know? Like the dog, you know? Don't do this, you know? You're not family. We have a religion. Don't go outside the religion, you know? Then what happened is that he refused to do that. He was still inquiring about Deen Ibrahim. So he sent him, Zayd ibn Amr, outside of Makkah and had some, for example, his henchmen look after him to make sure that he doesn't come to Makkah. Because he was inquiring everyone, he was telling everyone, all the youth in Makkah, he was telling them, listen, Deen Ibrahim is the religion, that's what we need to follow, that's the right religion of our forefathers, this is what we need to do. Everywhere he was going, he was talking and people were like, listen man, you need to do something about this guy. So his uncle was upset at him, that's why he had him outside of Makkah, would not let him come into Makkah. When he could not come to Makkah, so what he did is that he went to Sham. He went to Sham inquiring about Deen Ibrahim. He went to Sham inquiring about that, and when he went around Sham, he asked people there, he met the Christians there, the monks over there, and every place they went, they said, well, we don't know about that, but here's our Bible, you know. He said, listen, I don't want to know what you sell, you know. I want to know about this. Right? If you have this, tell me. Everyone's trying to propagate their own thing. He did not want to hear that. He did not want to hear that. He said, listen, I want to know about Deen Ibrahim. Deen Ibrahim. And he asked so many people, no one had the answers. And one last time he went to someone. And that monk, when he asked him, he said, listen, this is the Bible, you should read this. He said, no, I want to know about Deen Ibrahim. So he said, listen, why do you want to know about Deen Ibrahim for? That is going to be finished soon. He said, what do you mean? He said, because the place you came from, the last messenger of Allah is going to come there soon. He's going to come there and he's going to declare himself there. His prophet is going to be there. And he will be the end of all religions. And he will have the religion for the rest of mankind. He said, the best thing for you to do is go back there. Go back there and wait for him. And when he comes, accept him. Then you have accepted the best religion. You see? So with that in mind, now he knew that the last messenger is coming in Makkah. So Zayd ibn Amr was on his way back to Makkah when he was assassinated in the middle by some highway robbers. He was killed in the middle, and when he was killed in the middle, he died. The Prophet later on, and I want you to understand his statement and the eloquence of his statement really well. Alluding to Zayd ibn Amr, he said, Zayd ibn Amr is the only one in his family who will be raised to heaven.
Oh, subhanAllah.
Maybe you didn't understand my point.
Ya Allah.
Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Now you understood, right? Zayd ibn Amr. Who did Zayd ibn Amr was? Now understand. Four friends met each other, my friends, and I want this to be known. They rejected Ba'tha. But you see that when the time came to accept the truth, they were not ready. This is ideology is there, right? This type of ideology is there. When the, when you look at Ubaydullah ibn Jahsh, he rejected the batil. Said this batil is wrong. And he, when Islam came, you see that he was not able to be with it. When the truth came, he wasn't able to be with it. This ideology existed then, and it existed in Islam also.
Subhanallah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
This ideology still exists in Islam today.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I want to explain this to you. Just understand this, my friends. I want to explain this to you so you know this very well. The Abbasi rulers, right? I'm going to go through this fast, so that you understand this. And this is very important to know. The Abbasi rulers, after Ma'mun, when they were able to conquer a land in Russia, which we know as Kyrgyzstan, to them this was a good find because of the fact that they were having a hard time with the Muslims, the Arab Muslims, the Iranians, and all these people, because all the Muslims knew about Ahlul Bayt, especially after Imam Radha. They all knew about Ahlul Bayt, they knew about Imam Radha, they knew that these are the ones who are pious, they are the ones who have the knowledge, they are the ones who have Islam. The problem with the rulers, especially after Ma'mun, is that they were not able to find people that they can trust. They could not find people that they can trust because they need to have protection also in their palaces. They need to have their own guards. And if those guards, if they were closer to Ahlul Bayt, then they're going to kill these people. They're going to harm them, right? So what happened is that they wanted guards who do not have any clue of who the Prophet is and who Ahlul Bayt are, so that they can train them just to guard us. And hence, when this place in Russia was conquered, they brought those people who just became Muslim straight to their palace. And not just to their palace. They said that if we bring them in our capital, which was Baghdad then. If we bring them there, then those people there, like other people around Baghdad, all the people who live in Baghdad, they will tell that no, I mean, these are the true Muslims. The Ahlul Bayt are the true Muslims, this and that. They will inform them. So how can they protect their guards from the Muslims now? So just because of that, they made a new city to become the capital, and they called it Surraman Ra'a, which became known as later on as Samarra. This was a city that was built to keep the Muslims away from their guards, to get themselves protected. And this was a capital such that they would not allow any Muslim to come there. Only official visitors, that's it. It was not a city, it was actually like an encampment, an army encampment. Garrison, that's right. An army garrison, where the army was and the capital was. No other business there. That's the way it was. And then you see this, my friends. This was the way they did it. And the way they had it is because they wanted to have someone around them who they can trust. But you see what happened. The problem that happened was that when these people became Muslims, right, and they have been taught just to protect the leader, the king. When they looked at the king, they saw the king drinking illicit relationships, just, you know, not praying, nothing. They just saw these people as being debaucherous, with no moral values, nothing. And so they're looking at it, and as a human being, when you hear that this person is a religious leader, you expect certain ethical values, you know, some standards. When you see them being the lowest of the low, you know, you look at, are you a religious leader? I mean, we are better off in Christianity, man, you know. We are better off there. Right? So what happened to these people that were there, they were completely unknowing, but they understood that, hey, listen, these people were wrong. These people were wrong. You know, I mean, at least we know this. This is wrong. If there is some other Islam which is true, we haven't seen it. We haven't seen it. So now you see, Allah had to make arrangements for them to learn Islam. All the people learn Islam. You see, the message of Islam went to everyone. The message of Islam went to everyone in the Muslim world, meaning of Ahlul Bayt, except for the people in Samarra. Now Allah had to bring that message there. Now if you wanted to go there and pay them money to go in the city and preach, you were not allowed to. You see that? And hence, Mutawakkil, who was the king at the time, he wanted to destroy Karbala. Won't destroy Karbala. He said, but I can't destroy Karbala as long as the Imam of the Shias is out there. I need to bring him in, lock him down, and then do what I have to do. So he sent a letter to Imam Hadi alayhi salam. He sent a letter to Imam Hadi, and then he said that I have some issues, I need answers, and please, we want you to come here as a guest, and I've sent an escort for you. So they will, with respect, they're going to bring you here. So you see, Imam was not forced to go there. Imam Hadi was too strong in Medina to be forced. Because after Imam Radha, Ahlul Bayt had a lot of power in their hands. They had a lot of influence in their hands. He wasn't forced to go to Samarra. But you see, everyone had the message of Islam except for the people in Samarra.
Subhanallah.
You see, Allah wanted him to go to Samarra. And it's Allah's planning that not if Imam wanted to go himself, he wouldn't be allowed to go in Samarra. Mm-hmm. But Allah's planning was such that the king invited him to
Samarra.
So when when the Imam went to Samarra, then you see he went there and those people that were there, they looked at him, they looked at the king, and they saw the two brands of Islam. They saw the two brands of Islam. One brand where there is worship and devotion and sincerity and knowledge. And one brand where there is drinking and alcohol and sin and debauchery. And they knew right away that yes, this is the Islam we were looking for. You see that? This is the Islam we were looking for. Now Allah, always, when you reject the batin, because these people rejected the kings and they said that these are not true Muslims. Now it's Allah's job to give them the truth so that they also have the chance to accept the truth. They also have the chance to accept the truth. That's why Imam Hadi was brought into Samarra. And just like that, you see, if you understood that, then you know that the message that Imam Hussein wanted to give, he should have given it in Sham, not in Karbala. Because that's where the message was needed to be given. But you see, it was Allah's planning that Hussein would be martyred in Karbala and Zainab would give the message in Sham. This is how you see Allah works. So if you see, my friend, understand this. Prophet came in the land of Jahiliyyah. If you see yourself in the land of the new Jahiliyyah, then understand why you're here. It is there because you are here to give them the opportunity to accept Islam. Not that they're going to, but you're giving them the opportunity so they cannot say we didn't have the chance. That we didn't have the chance. Right? Just like the people who were in Samarra, they had the opportunity. They didn't accept it, now it's on them. But they had the chance. They had the message there. My friends, this is, you see, the situation at the time. On one hand, just to wrap it up, on one hand, the ignorance, the arrogance, the pride, and the religiousness of the Arabs. And on the other side, you had a group of people who were thinkers. Even though later on they did not be with Islam, but they were thinkers and they raised the awareness amongst people that this idol worship is wrong. And hence, the time and the ground was ready for the Prophet to declare Islam. To declare Islam. Why? Because there were those few who were thinkers and who were propagating that message to the youth, to the youngsters and everywhere. So now when he will come, now people who had heard from these people that the religion they had is wrong, now when they see the real religion come, they will have the chance to accept it. And hence the grounds were ready for the Prophet's declaration, and then we will go into that detail of how he declared his Islam next week, inshallah. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the tawfiq and the blessing to be on the right path. Give us the wisdom to understand His guidance. Hasten the reappearance of our Imam. Make us His helper when He comes. Wa akhir da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Allahumma salli ala